Global Center for Global Interdependence Center, um eben über dieses sehr, sehr spannende Thema zu sprechen, das eben nicht nur für Finanzfachleute maßgeblich ist oder sehr, sehr einflussreich ist, sondern für jede und für jeden von uns. Deshalb ist es wirklich für mich eine ganz besondere Freude, dass Sie heute so zahlreich hier sind. Ich möchte Sie ganz kurz noch darauf hinweisen, auf zwei Dinge. Einerseits, Sie haben bei der Anmeldung diesen Zettel erhalten, das ist ein Stimmzettel, den Sie hoffentlich in zwei Teile getrennt haben und die erste Stimme bereits in die bereitstehende Box eingeworfen haben. Und die zweite Stimme, die werden wir am Ende des Tages nochmals erfassen, eben dieselbe Box, um zu sehen, ob wir wirklich einen Beitrag zur Meinungsbildung in diesem schwierigen Thema haben leisten können. Denn dieses schwierige Thema wird uns auch nach dem 10. Juni, dem letzte Woche festgelegten Datum der Abstimmung, der Volksabstimmung, weiter begleiten. Dafür ist nicht zuletzt auch der technische Fortschritt verantwortlich. Und das deshalb eben, wie gesagt, es ist nicht irgendwie jetzt ein bestimmtes nur für die Abstimmung relevantes Thema, sondern wirklich ein großes Thema über die Verfassung unseres Geldes. In diesem Sinne freut es mich sehr und ich wünsche uns allen einen anregenden, vielleicht sogar einen aufregenden, aber in jedem Fall sicher einen lehrreichen Tag. Ich danke Ihnen vielmals, ich gebe das Wort weiter an Uli Korsch, unseren Tagesmoderator. Danke.
Hallo, bienvenue à tous. La plupart de notre programme c'était en anglais, mais vous pouvez utiliser des. What's that in French? I think a lot of you are probably going to need headsets. Are there more headsets in the back? Maybe if you could come forward, if you would like a headset, put your hand up, and hopefully you can still get one. How's that? Deutsch ist für mich viel leichter als Französisch. Sogar mit dem Namen Uli, nicht? Da muss man auch Deutsch sprechen können. Ne? Das kann ich sagen. I want to start off again by welcome you all. It's wonderful to have you here. I want to thank a few people who really made this possible. First of all, from GDI, I will introduce David Bossard later, but Alessandro and Christina. Is Christina here in the room? Alessandro, you want to just stand up? Thank you. Without all the endless back and forth, we would not be here. The other person is Jill Fornito from the Global Interdependence Center. As I always say, the real brains behind making it happen. I'm a member. And it has been a fabulous pleasure for me to work together with Chris Dreyer, who you met earlier here today. If you ever need anybody to really work with here as far as CFA, he's the man. He's fabulous. Thank you ever so much. All right, welcome once more. Let's. I don't know. Hopefully, you can read at least one or two of those languages. Please, could you shut your cell phones off? That would be really, really helpful. A company that I worked with for many years, we had a very simple process. We had a glass bowl in the middle of all of our meetings. Every time anybody's cell phone went off, in went your business card. Every business card was $10. And then every month when we had a party ready, we would put all the business cards, and let me tell you, we had good parties. the cell phones kept on going off. Let's get to why we're here. As Chris already said, hopefully you understood him, this is a really important topic, and to try to pick this apart and understand the nuances of what this is all about and who it really affects. So we are here openly to discuss matters that ultimately affect millions. We need to unpack. We need to, you know, take out the socks and the shirts and the shoes and try to figure out, what does this really mean? It's not just theory. I know there's going to be some, you know, fairly high-end economic theory discussed. What is politically possible? How does it change human lives? That's ultimately what this is all about. It's not a dry, esoteric topic, ultimately, in its effects. Parts of it, maybe, I understand that. But that's really not what it's all about. And the fact that the room is full, I think, says something. There's real interest, real understanding that this is important. I want to tell you, here's a phrase for you. Nobody, that includes me, includes you, nobody knows everything about anything. Mm-hmm. We all need each other. And the people who are going to be making presentations, they don't all agree. But that's fine. We can come together and coalesce a greater truth, a greater level of understanding that would not be possible. I've put many boards together, corporate and nonprofits. My point is always to look for people who don't necessarily agree with me. I don't need people who agree with me. I already agree with myself. Quite bummy. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I do. Well, occasionally I'm confused, but I do agree with myself. So we have different speakers and a range of opinions, not because we want to fight with each other, but because we want to learn from one another. That's what this is all about. Otherwise, what's the point of having a day-long session, right? Some of us here are well known. We have an incredible array of speakers. They're not being paid for this. One of the speakers, as a matter of fact, Bill Dunkelberg, I cannot believe he's here. His flight was canceled. It wasn't delayed, it was canceled. I was getting texts from him at 2 and 3 in the morning. His time. He made it. He's here. That's the kind of push, the kind of interest that there is here. And I want you to value that. It's a banquet of beautiful, different kinds of meals that are being offered from people around the world who really, really care. So I want you in the audience and you as speakers to be able to present, because later on you're going to have an opportunity to do that, with confidence, but not with ego. The point isn't that I need to prove that I'm a great man or woman or whatever, but how do we listen to one another? How do we hear what the other person is saying before we formulate our answer? And you, we're going to have a major session towards the end where you have an opportunity to participate and to ask questions. Do so openly and honestly, but it's not that we have to prove that we're some great people, right? Schumacher, economics is a people matter. Ultimately, as I already said, it's not great theory. It's the effect on human beings. The referendum here on June the 10th affects millions of people, but it does much more than that. So we don't make the decision here, I understand that. But the effects of that ripple around throughout the whole country and throughout the whole world. There's a meaning. We have people here from all over the world. At least one person flew in all the way from Australia for this conference. Does that say something to you? It shows you the interest, the understanding, the need for this topic. Let me shift gears. What the referendum and what this discussion is all about? It is not even primarily for us. It's for our children and our grandchildren, because the effects will not occur for another 25 or 50 years that will ripple through the economy. Because we are seeing changes. There is a paradigm shift in banking and in money that, irrespective of what the Swiss referendum will decide, is happening. It cannot be stopped, but it can be formulated. It can be woven properly. And that's really what we're trying to do in the midst of this change. We have gone from paper to electronic to what in the world is that? By the way, you'll find this very interesting. I'll talk about this, Roy. That is actually the word digital. And I can't remember what type style I used, but that's literally what came out. So paper money is what we've had for the last 400 years. I mean, I know the Chinese had paper money thousands of years ago, but I'm talking about us here, all right? Today, almost everything is electronic money. In the US, it's over 99%. Here in Switzerland, it's about 90%. Electronic money is bank money, Girogeld, right? Money that is in your account that is electronic. It is not paper money, it's not currency. And we are all going to that. What in the world does that mean? Is there relevance to what we're talking about here towards the future? As I said already, the decision isn't so much for today, the decision is for tomorrow. I formulated some questions, and depending on what side of the debate you're on, none of you will like all of these questions. You'll be happy to know I haven't sent these to anybody, okay? Because I didn't want anybody to get a leg up on anybody else, because you're going to disagree on some of the answers. And hopefully the questions will make all of you here at the front sweat a little bit. These are some of the things that, as far as I'm concerned, that need to be answered. So for that future, for that paradigm shift, what is better, the current debt-based system or an equity-based system? And by the way, Jordan, you know, the chairman of the Swiss National Bank, just gave a talk 10 days ago, very recently. So, and he used that, so I didn't dream this up. He used the term debt-based, all right? Because that's what we are. That's not what we live in. If you don't understand that, that'll be explained later on today. The Folgeld system says, let's stop that, and let's go to an equity-based system. What in the world does that mean? This is a radical shift, all right? We need answers to that question. By the way, we're going to roll these through later on. I'm not going to talk about these, but when we have the major discussion at the end, they'll be rolled through so you can ask questions that are relevant to some of this. What is the real cost of money? We tend to use different words. I use visible and inherent. We tend to use real and nominal. That's not what I'm talking about. First of all, we have a rate that is listed, and then we add or subtract inflation, so that's the difference between the nominal rate is the rate as shown, and the real rate is differential from inflation or deflation, right? That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm going way beyond that. We have economic crashes on a regular basis. That is part of the cost of money. Where's an analysis of that? I've never seen it. That's a true cost that we all bear because of the kind of money system that we've decided to have. All right? Where's the answer to that? Who pays for that? Who doesn't? If not, why not? In my mind, I'd like to know that. Okay? How would this change in the Folgeld system? Would it improve or would it not? I'd like to know that. All right? These are really simple questions, as you can tell. Yeah. By the way, there's no way these are all going to be answered here today. All right? But these are deeply philosophical questions. They're not just economic questions. Okay? The whole thing of liquidity, the capacity for loans, the capacity for financing in different situations. It's really what liquidity is, all right? How is it going to be controlled? What are the advantages, disadvantages? Will it essentially be equal, or would the equity-based, the Folgeld system, squeeze the economy? That's what some people think. Well, would it or wouldn't it? Are there segments of the economy that would serve better or worse? Seigniorage. You'll hear about seigniorage. What in the world is this thing? This is a huge function within our financial system. We don't talk about it, okay? Who is getting that money right now? I'll give you a bear. If you don't know what seigniorage is, I'll help you. Seigniorage is the difference between the value of money and the cost of producing it. So let's take a 1 franc note, 10 franc notes. I don't think there are any 1 franc notes, okay? And let's say it costs, you know, 10 centimes, das zu drucken, then the seigniorage is the difference between the 10 cents that it costs to produce it and the 10 francs, all right? So who in the world gets that today? Because we have a bunch of that money kicking around, especially electronic money, costs virtually nothing to produce. So where in the world does that go? Is that good or not? Okay, why don't we ever talk about this from a political perspective? It's a huge part of our economics. No, I'm not going to talk about it. I just dreamed this up. I spoke at a conference just a couple of weeks ago, and in the spur of the moment, I dreamed all these attributes up. I figured this is kind of heaven on earth money. I'm not sure any currency in the world fulfills every one of those, or perhaps it never will, but this is what I would like to dream towards. Okay. Wow, that's an unbelievable list. Anyway, and you'll see it later on. I don't want to talk about it. I don't have time to talk about it. This is not a new subject. I'm giving you this is a top down. So, by the way, some of these dates are real. Some of these dates I just picked. For instance, I'm sorry, wrong button. So we had 8,000 different kinds of currencies, and I just picked a year before those all stabilized in the U.S. It's not in the year 1850. It's around that time. Every bank had the right to print their own money, and they did. And it was all very local, and chaos ensued. Okay. In 1891, there was a referendum here, an Abstimmung, same thing we're going to have on June the 10th, where it was decided that only the Bund, the central government, can create currency or facsimiles. That's an English word that I simply use for money. I can't remember exactly what but it's basically what it means. All right. The only they are allowed to produce that. Well, then in 1929, we had the stock market crash at the beginning of the Great Depression. Okay, so as a result of that, the Chicago Plan came out in 1935. The Chicago Plan and Folge is not the same thing. Things have changed in the last 100 years. We have learned things, and the money system has changed. And so the Folge initiative and sort of sovereign money attempts to work through today's system. All right. 1950, in spite of the fact that the Constitution says this is illegal, banks were doing it. To a huge extent, in spite of the fact that the Constitution categorically said it's illegal. So guess what? In 1999, they simply changed the Constitution. You can now do what it is that you've been doing anyway for the last 50 or 60 years. And now that we have 2018, what's going to happen now? Okay. Just a quick overview of the conference. We've got three sections, and then three, I'm just calling them synopses, overviews. So we've got the current monetary system as far as the sections. Then people who are saying, yes, I'm in favor of change. No, I'm not in favor of change. Okay, this section is really, really important. Because if you don't understand how the current system works, none of this makes any sense. And then the synopses. Sorry about this. So David Bossart will start with respect to complexity, who's in charge, then Martin Wolf as to an overview of the global situation, and then at the end we have a long open discussion where we try to encapsulate what everybody has talked about. Okay, I just want to say something very short about introductions. There is no time. You have a booklet that has everybody's resume in there. My introductions will be exceedingly short. I would be embarrassed under normal situations, but I don't know what else to do, because that's the way it is. David, start the race.
Oh, God.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're on. I'd like us to thank our host here, GDI, David Bossart, who's the CEO of GDI, and he will now lead on.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you, Christian. Great partners, great conference. As you probably know, GDI likes to host and to partner of great idea conferences. Last year, we had with our neighbors, which is the IBM Research Lab at Swiss Re Institute, a great conference about blockchain. 2 years ago, it was about universal basic income, another initiative referendum that has been voted. So again, today, I think we're having a great conference. It's my great pleasure to give you an overview on more on the global political, economic, social side. Our specialty is finding out where technology goes and what this has as an effect on human behavior. So the title, I think, is very great. Our money, our banks, our countries first. What does it mean when you say our money? What does it mean when we say money? Money today is moving rapidly, you saw it in Uli's chart, much more towards complex software, towards digital data. This is a huge difference. We do not understand it. Banks. What does it mean when you say our banks? Banks are now experiencing probably what Bill Gates famously said in 1994, banking is essential, banks are not. With ever more disintermediation, it becomes much more easier for other operators, call it Amazon, Alibaba, to be also part of the financial systems and taking market share away of banks. So you can call it in a formula, we are witnessing retail sanity, wholesale madness. Countries are moving now towards weaker nation states. Globally, with the exception probably of China, weaker nation states and fragmented governments. Nation states might prevail, but they are losing power continuously. The shift is now towards connected cities. The real economic powerhouses are connected cities that basically don't need any hinterland anymore. They are very strong and they attract the brightest minds, they attract the talents, call them the global nomads, call them also denationalized elites. They don't care about the specific nation. They don't feel attached to laws in a certain nation. They optimize their career. And of course, you cannot forbid that. It's okay. But this changes the rules of the games, and this changes the rules of the nations. What does it mean for regulation in countries? We don't know. But probably we will see more regulation. And the question is, what kind of regulation will we see in the future? I'm going to argue basically the tech, or more precisely the use of data, data aggregation and data analysis is already sort of a second economy, a superstructure that works above the established economy. Tech now stacks the established economy. It is setting the standards not only for organizational patterns, it is setting the standards for business models, for productivity and even for wealth creation. So digital tech, and especially data, is the referee, you might say, when we try to create order or disorder in our liberal Western democracies. But for the first time, and this is really new, with ever better tech infrastructure like cloud and massive computing power, we can for the first time now really leverage the potentialities. You know, artificial intelligence is a very old idea, very old technology, but we can leverage only today with massive computing power. With cloud computing and robotics and blockchain is possible today for the good or for the bad. When you look at any kind of businesses and the financial industry is just joining the crowd, all major innovations over the last few years have probably been software-driven, software innovation, or at least software in disguise. So when we look at the most innovative companies, the most innovative countries, you see that those who can learn faster, those who can adopt new technologies better, they are more agile, they are more innovative also in catering to people. Who is in charge? It's very difficult to say. I guess the technology is now becoming more important and more important than ever before. Last year, this place, Axel Weber, chairman of UBS, had a speech and he said, well, large financial institutions, we are already technology companies. Take whatever you want, and you know the figures better than me, but when you just look at how much finance is now being optimized, how much you see in transactions that is fully automated, and it goes up, and it goes up. When you look at the automotive industry, probably the business model of the last century, you see that we are step by step entering a new ecosystem that is software-driven, data-driven. We are moving with ever better sensors to self-driving cars. If you make a parallel, I think it might be appropriate to say that finance is now marching towards self-driving finance and self-driving investments. So it is even correct to say that we are becoming more and more the machines we are creating. The famous quote you probably are familiar with from Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian media thinker, prophet, who said, we shape our tools, and afterwards, our shoe tools are shaping us. So we are becoming the machines we are creating. So what I call smart technocracy, we are moving towards a more technologically driven system. It might go in one direction that is more anarchistic. It might be democratic. That's what we all hope. But when we look to China, we see that technocracy in a totalitarian disguise is already here and it's very strong. And I'm not sure what kind of system might win. So we are back in the old game of what is the better system for the future. And for sure we need a deeper discussion. Uli said it already, we cannot leave these discussions to the techie guys, we cannot leave it to the finance economists or to the bankers. This is something that concerns us all. Probably the best quote I found recently is that trust is now moving away from human beings and human institutions, more and more moving towards in code we trust. I think the quote by Tim Wu, a law professor at Columbia, who says the reason to think something deeper and more important is going on. Bitcoin, just as a case study, Bitcoin's rise might reflect, for better or worse, a monumental transfer of social trust away from human institutions, backed by government, to systems reliant on well-tested computer code. It is a trend that transcends finance in our fear of human error, or we are putting an increasingly deep faith in technology. I think at least, if we think seriously about that, we can, when we analyze our own behavior, see how we deeply depend on tech and how trust is shifting. When you look at the most innovative companies, companies that have the most consumer trust, most often is already a technology company. Why? Because they solve a problem I have in my everyday lives. So it's nothing abstract, they solve a very concrete problem. You might not love Amazon as a citizen, but you pretty much love Amazon as an investor and as a consumer, because they deliver and solve a problem. So the Bitcoin case is an excellent case to see that it is not just about what the mainstream narrative says. It's, of course, it's about speculation, it might be a bubble, it might be greed, it might be herd behavior, but much more interesting is that this is just a sign that we are losing trust in human institutions, and we believe that Kant is can be more trusted. So when we look back at the dot-com crash in the late 90s, it was the time when completely new business models emerged, when we learned how difficult it is to measure productivity appropriately, and it was the time of weak, untested, unexperienced tech that was still underpowered and hardware-driven. Today we are rapidly moving from hardware world to the software world, and hardware is not and software is no longer the prisoner of hardware. Also, when you look back the last 20 years, the best companies that emerged at that stage were not only surviving, they're the strongest now in business globally. Think Amazon, think Netflix, think Priceline, think Google. So again, when we look at where trust goes, it becomes clear that all this better tested code is having an important impact on personal trust we feel towards brands and towards companies. Even in healthcare and mobility, we put more and more trust in code and well-tested computer code. So in the end, it boils down to the question, where is trust going? Where do we put trust into? So again, take any statistical long-term analysis, take the Edelman Barometer that always comes out for the World Economic Forum. We see the trust is moving away from humans and human institutions more towards well-functioning, trusted code and technology. Or just think of what's happened with the hashtag MeToo or with President Trump. What these phenomenons, movements, and persons do to the trust in males. The trust in males is declining. So again, this is a blow to humans. And when you no longer trust humans, we have serious problems in operating also on a political base. What is going on? Finance just seems to keep up with the broader trends, and I think that is true when we look at all the human errors we witnessed during the big meltdown in 2007 and 2008. So provocatively said to a computer programmer, ladies and gentlemen, the financial system looks a bit like untested code with weak debugging. It looks a bit like untested code with weak debugging. So again, even if you think, and I think that's correct to say, trends like Bitcoin might not be the future of currencies or the way to invest for the many, but it is a symptom, and it shows certain alternatives that might get better step by step as the continuous improvement of software will help us to prevent bigger failures. Just compare also the learning curve of humans, compare that to the learning curve of well-functioning technology. So this might also mean that data-driven services could be the core products in the future. So when you look at what data does, basically data brings us cognitive services that we no longer, we do not yet know what the clear value of that is. When you look back, we said, looking at the banknotes, in God we trust. This was the expression still available in US coins and banknotes. You can say in the industrial world, we basically trusted more and more in expert knowledge, or we trusted in leadership of great leaders in the political arena. But today, we get a, you get a sensitivity for huge changes witnessed over the last two decades. In code we trust, Larry Lessig said, Harvard law professor, is probably becoming, to say really provocatively, is becoming more important. Code is law is the best formula I ever learned. And it works. In all our studies we did, we can confirm for, that for regular people, ordinary people, the regular population, convenience is very important. So it just works. It is convenient, it is simple. Yeah, have simple access to something is the most important for people. Probably not for experts, they think about it. But for people, it's how practical it is, how easy it is to manage. This is the most important. So again, a citizen might not like Amazon, but basically, as someone who uses the tools, they are quite good. So to finish the Bitcoin case, the first Bitcoin billionaires, the twin brothers Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, put it, Bitcoin is not the new gold, it is more than that, it is a programmable store of money. That's very, very well said. It is a programmable store of money. And it may, might continue to innovate. And again, when we look at China, I think China is the most advanced in all these issues. If you want a simple binary change of mindset, we're always talking about paradigms, that's true, but it helps to simplify things. We might say we are moving a data world out of the old industrial world that is kind of framed by scarcity. We are moving to much more abundance. Because as we now derive data from people, from animals, from plants, from machines, from things, from any kind of possible data bearer, so we see also that we are moving towards a much more software, consumer-driven logic. And when you go down also, I think that the next step will be we will have more a world of continuous, small, controlled improvements and pragmatic learning culture and going away from the old temporary big disasters with extended recovery kind. If we get the tech thing right, very visionary wise spoken, we can have a better future. The old world is basically, we can put it in two metaphors, tanker and silo. The new one is also a little bit dangerous, I agree, drones and cruise missiles. But again, when we look at the big revolutions, technological revolutions in humanity, there were only three. The first one was the written language, the second one was money, and the third one now is data software. And software is probably much more powerful because you always have to ask, how can you store something, how can you transfer it, and how can you multiply it? Then it becomes obvious that, of course, data is even more powerful than any kind of money you might imagine. But this is a different mindset. And I will give you just one quote, looking at the clock, just one quote that sounds quite geekish, but it's from an MIT professor. It looks very technocratic, but I think it shows the mindset of the techy people. And he says, David Clark, at a conference in 1992, just before the internet really became mainstream, how they operate when they just code, when they make programs. We reject kings, presidents, and workers. We believe in rough consensus and run code. Of course, it's always humans behind the code. But nonetheless, the key is a practical, operational working system that can quickly adopt, be implemented, and you're continuously learning by small steps. Now you have a rough consensus means you have strong views but weakly held because you adopt. You have strong views, you know the direction, you know you make a mistake, and then you adopt again. And at least in theory, we do have the computing power to go in that direction today. we like at GDI always to do maps. When we don't understand something, we try to create maps. And when we look at how disruption really works, we said we need to take into consideration two things. One is the state of technology, but even more importantly, what is the social acceptance of a certain technology? Unspoken, you might say the mindset, the social acceptance is basically the key whether we move ahead with technology or not. And also when you look at sovereign money, it becomes clear we have a lot of theory. I think the technology, it's envisioned, probably prototype, it could be applied, probably, but if you don't have the social acceptance, and this means on one side, on the technology side, do we have enough research for the theory to put it into practice, and on the other side, for the mindset, do we have the social acceptance? And to gain social acceptance, ladies and gentlemen, you need what? You need better communication. So in order to look at what's going on, you have to have a clear vision of what's going on in the field of social acceptance in a democratically legitimized background. So you have different phases you go through, and then we see you can only have disruption and get a mind shift if you have a coordinating mindset. I think that's very important to see. And then we can understand what it takes until something is just far out, not socially accepted, controversial, a niche, and then it moves over. Many in technology, you can see that how fast, for example, the iPhone mobile commerce became naturalized incredibly fast because it solved the problem and socially it was highly accepted. But without that, if it is not socially accepted, we need much more communication and a better understanding. And it should not be just restrained and confined into the elite discussion. So when we look at what's going on over the history of money, and we just talked briefly about it, we see that we are moving towards something that tells us the more we become a complex world, the more we are technology-driven, the more we depend on basically trust. We lend trust to something we do not understand. So we need the courage to experiment and to try out. This is the case with technology. You see that basically progress is the result of more trust in a more abstract, advanced technological systems. It's fascinating also when you see old technologies. You can call cash a technology. Cash is not dead. Cash is even stronger than ever. So this shows also that a lot of people have high interest in cash, that it not only prevails, but probably even becomes stronger. So new technology does not necessarily wise mean that all technologies are fast dying away. They might remain. But I want to point out another interesting thing. We used to say that take something at face value, or you really trust. The more we move deeper into the complex digital ecosystem, the less we talk about face value. The face is basically disappearing. We move from face value to interface value. So trust in the interface is becoming the real asset in a global digital economy. So when you look at the battle of the biggest platforms, the biggest technology companies, you see who defines. The interface wins. So the biggest battle right now is about conversational technology. But conversational technology, you just need to talk and no longer to write something down, to operate the machine. This is just the next step of convenience. And when you look how fast Alexa, the conversational technology of Amazon, is gaining trust, you see that it is gaining momentum, and then we are in a new ecosystem. Think back 15 years, ladies and gentlemen. 15 years back, only people said, I'm never ever going to buy something on the internet. Amazon books, no. That's too dangerous. That's not safe. Thanks to Amazon, this is no longer a question. So it shows us how we can move quite fast. Or also when you look at Alibaba or the big Chinese guys, they are heavily investing in all interface values. They are in interfaces. For example, they're investing in bikes because then they have access to the payment system and then they can control the interface of the user. So it's all about who has the best access to the interface of someone, because this is the easiest way and the most convenient way. But wait a minute. We must be aware that data also changes the nature of competition. Look at the big companies. And data quality, of course, is key. With artificial intelligence, we can perfectionize data by extracting more value, especially also in real time. But the challenge is, each of these data classes is also a new asset class. But what is the pricing model behind it? And here we can clearly see, as long as data has not an appropriate price, as long as it is not categorized, as long as we have no reliable model behind it, without, you might call it, infonomics, data owners always win. And you can easily predict, as long as the big guys are not willing to be more transparent and to open up for a pricing model for the data we as users produce, their value might go up more and more. So we are degraded as data producers. We produce the data basically for free. We get nothing for that. Well, that is also a scandal. But what we are given is cognitive services, and it's highly valued because it has a high value in our practical lives. But those who can really produce, and not the producer has not the chance to be the driver's seat, but those who can aggregate the data, who can analyze, they have the most power right now. I will not go deeper into that, but now the question is, what kind of structural change are we going to witness over the next years? Is it really true that we are going to have, even with blockchain, more decentralized systems, a more decentralized approach to transactions and all the things we like to do in an easier way? I'm not so sure yet. There are, of course, many visions. The thing is, big visions rarely come from within a certain business or a certain system. So the vision for self-driving cars is not an idea of Volkswagen or for General Motors, and the idea of blockchain was not an idea, the idea that grew out of HSBC or JP Morgan. But the funny thing is, you basically need one strong person with a strong vision, and then you can just shake up a whole industry. So this was the case with Elon Musk, and of course this was also the case with Bitcoin, with the Satoshi Nakamoto, the name used by the person who invented Bitcoin. So one person alone can be extremely powerful, and that's basically good news. But on the other side, when we have more and more trends towards decentralization, we only see a strong counter trend towards new sorts of power structures. I don't have the time to go into detail, but I think, again, a very good quote from the Square and Tower new book by Neil Ferguson, who says, "The lesson of history is that trusting in networks to run the world is a recipe for anarchy." That's very interesting. So my guess is that we move towards a combination of more networks, but also more control and hierarchy, even in a Western world. Let me go toward the next point. What is the result? Are we moving more towards digital maoism or digital anarchy? A little bit also democratically underlined. Are we having more big data and central technocracy or free market and a scary situation of weak, low trust government institutions? Probably you know that China is establishing a powerful tool of fixing and predicting future failures better and acting preventively. We have to acknowledge that China is far ahead in terms of use and speed of execution when it comes to digital tools and businesses of any kind. How stable that is another question. But at least they have a clear idea. They know what they want. We don't at all. And again, the pace of innovation, no longer just copying or stealing, experimentation and adaptation, learning is very breathtaking. Just to give you one example, I could cite the hundreds, China now accounts for more than 40% of global e-commerce transactions, up from less than 1% a decade ago, according to the McKinsey Global Institute. So that's absolutely breathtaking. And with its social credit score, it can monitor dysfunctional, inappropriate behavior. It started with individuals who apply for a credit, and giants like Tencent, Alibaba, and now JD.com are obliged to share their extremely detailed data about all the individuals they gather with central authorities like the People's Bank in China, meaning its central bank. Imagine that for a Western nation. Then, but this is not done yet, the People's Bank shares this data with about 50 state-owned banks. And this creates a database that covers approximately 400 million people. That includes all the consumer patterns, product preferences, payment histories, social media communications. This is a chart originally established by the Wall Street Journal, another great publication after the Financial Times. All this helps to establish knowledge about bringing down household debt. So they very cleverly tried to establish predictive tools to bring down household debt. And Chinese consumers and employees now know that credit scores matter for their personal future. This is the privacy issue, of course. Be very in tune with standards that pile up debt because it might affect your career. When you register today in any kind of, as an employee, you have face recognition. When you go into a church, you're being recognized and it might hurt your credit score. You can still apply for a mortgage, but your interest rate might be higher. This is how the flexible system in China is going to operate right now. It is said that this, not yet finished, it is said that a similar system is going to be established also for companies. So the People Banks of China's Credit Reference Center is in charge. This will cover a wide range of data, like account information, company social security payments, housing provident fund payments, administrative penalties and awards, tax arrears and court judgments, to assess whether a company is a good corporate citizen and a healthy credit risk. This helps to prevent debt addition and systems failure. The Western narrative, on the other side, is that central planning will sooner or later fail. This might be true. But it is a little bit more unclear when you see all the tremendous opportunities and possibilities we are going to acquire with ever better technology. Of course, manipulation, corruption might still prevail, but can we take that for granted for the future? We in the West must furthermore also appreciate that we are already going in the same direction. Take insurance companies that now can fix the annual policy in accordance to the data available about your behavior. How you drive, for example, is easily monitored. Take elderly people, take the young, so you can apply and discount a certain policy or have a premium on it. How you exercise can be much easier monitored, and it gives you access to cheaper health insurance. How you protect your home, now with Google Home and all these Alexa systems, for example, against burglars, it can be monitored. This will bring more transparency, but also more hyper-personalization, but implies a move away from old-style risk pooling. So in the end, and this is my conclusion, I'm exactly like, nearly like a Swiss clock, the results are going to be in the direction the same. As we expect huge efficiency gains, we just implement what is technologically possible. And China is, as I said, ahead in the speed of execution, so we can learn from their mistakes also. So provocatively said, Pax Technica is slowly arriving. We just do what we are told to do by ever better tech. So we cannot say what tech is going to tell us with artificial intelligence, but we know we can adapt, we should take the best out of it. And I think this is a very fascinating time, and I hope we have good discussions. Thank you very much for being with us.